Hello and welcome to Need to Know, your weekly investment podcast brought to you by the experts at Coutts. I'm Sarah Muir and I'm joined as always by Coutts CIO Alan Higgins. Each week on the podcast, we look at the three things we think investors need to know for the week ahead. But before we get to that, Alan, a quick sort of roundup of perhaps some of the things we've been talking about over the last couple of weeks. One thing I wanted to ask you about was we saw the Office for National Statistics come out with some revised UK GDP, and touching on, we've talked a lot previously about perhaps over pessimism about the UK economy. And well, maybe we were right all along.
Yes, you know, we're right about a few things, I guess, Sarah. So look, it's just very, very common for the ONS to underestimate GDP. To be fair, it's hard, especially with services being so important. But this has been going on for 20 odd years or more. I was actually reading an article about 04 to 07 upward revisions pre the financial crisis. So the numbers were, because everyone's framing in terms of recovery from the pandemic. Previously, we thought we were 1.2% smaller. We're now 0.6% larger. And what I've always said is that the most reliable statistic, and even that can break down, but the most reliable statistic is the employment data. That tends to be a bit harder. And the fact that the UK unemployment rate has been relatively low, that has always given me confidence that the UK economy is somewhat stronger than expected. It just puts it, by the way, in the middle of the pack of the G7. Yeah. But you can see the UK has had a bit of a negative PR. And yeah. At the margin, it's made people maybe pessimistic about sterling and the UK. Maybe not stocks, because stocks are, you know, most, especially the larger stocks, are global investments, but overdone. We're not saying here that everything in the UK is wonderful, clearly not.
No.
But yes, over pessimism on the UK, and now it's in the middle of the pack, somewhat stronger than Germany, recovery from the pandemic, and about in line with France, which is kind of what you would expect, right?
Well, exactly. That is what I would have expected, but it's nice to see that sort of confirmed now with that revision up, because I asked you before, I think, about often things are revised up or down. And this is a nice example of something being revised up. The only other thing I wanted to tell you about is I was doing a bit of research. We talked last week about whether diamonds are a store of, or a good investment, in sort of prompted by an article in the FT about lab-grown diamonds. And I found something that slightly contradicted what we were talking about last week. And there's an article in, it was in the Times over the weekend by somebody called Jessica Diamond, now nominative determinism at work there. And she'd written an article about why rocks are the new stocks. And she actually identified that for ultra high net worth investors, really rare coloured diamonds are actually quite a smart investment. Something like they're up 77% from 2010 to 2019. I'm quoting there the Fancy Colour Research Foundation. And do you know, I'm going to put you on the spot again because this is going to be my new hobby, the most expensive diamond sold at auction. Do you know how much that was?
$12 million.
Oh, way more than that.
Yeah,
way more than that. You're very cold on that one. $71.2 million. Yeah. That was for the Pink Star that was sold in 2017. It was 59.6 carats. Now, translated into sort of normal language, that apparently was roughly the size of a strawberry. Didn't say what size a strawberry was, but you're talking pretty big. And apparently it was flawless. So we were talking last week about lab-grown diamonds. And it seems that these really rare sort of colour diamonds are perhaps, that might be where the investment value is rather than in the sort of normal one. But interesting, I thought. Anyway, that's enough of...
Well, no, let me just come in on diamonds, because I had a conversation with an insider as well. Well, we did say in our defence that in the future, rare diamonds, we could kind of agree. That data, though, I would dispute. And in particular, bid offer spread, you know.
Yeah.
And I talked to an insider. Admittedly, this is standard white diamonds. You buy $10,000 worth of diamonds. Next day, go back, bid, $5,000.
Right.
$5,000 bid, $10,000 offered.
Yeah.
So, okay, this is relatively low value. But this is the issue with these alternative investments. But anyway, we'll come back.
And I would also just add, I imagine the market for a £70 million diamond is tiny as well.
Yeah, obviously, I didn't even know about it. So there you go. I'm not paying enough attention.
If you spend enough money, you can actually have the diamond named after you. So we could have a Higgins diamond.
Yeah, I think the world doesn't want to see that.
Okay, let's get down to business then. What are the three things we need to know this week, Alan?
So often we just kind of summarize US data, but I want to look at the US again, particularly the US. We had some data.
Yeah.
Soft landing. And, you know, why is the economy so resilient? So it's kind of answering that question, number one, but looking at the data at the same time. And then in the news, it's a bit UK focused, but it's similar whether you're a dollar investor or a euro investor. Basically, fixed rates being attractive. What's attracted the press over here is a 1 year national savings. That's a UK government guaranteed bond for 6.2%. How does that stack up? What do we think? And then finally, on our theme of alternative investments, we'll soon run out of these, but we'll carry on. Because a client did get in touch who owns Royal Albert Hall debentures. And, you know, quite an interesting story there. And we can talk about, you know, favourite concerts of the Royal Albert Hall as well.
Oh, definitely. Okay, sounds good. All right, and then let's kick off then with the US. And, of course, we have the jobs report out at the end of last week. And it was pretty positive, wasn't it?
Yeah, soft landing. It was exactly in line. So non-farm payrolls, 170,000, almost exactly in line. But the unemployment rate ticked up. Well, that doesn't sound good, but bad news is good news because maybe the US can stop raising rates. One, average hourly earnings, so wages were in line, and there was downward revisions. So the US classically, it is monthly data, so you'd expect some downward revisions. So overall, not a recession data. And before that, we've mentioned before, job openings. How many new job openings are there? And that's, you know, a lot of this is online, of course, these days. They're down some 25% from the highs. So basically, there's a softening and no recession. So that was the data, but it leads to, you know, why? Why aren't we not in recession?
That was going to be, so just to clarify then, when we talk about a soft landing, we're talking about the US, the Fed, being able to bring inflation under control without having to engineer or create a recession, which is normally how you would expect to get inflation back under control, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So basically, you know, to really bring inflation down historically, basically the US has done exactly, the Federal Reserve Board has done exactly what it's doing now, tighten monetary policy, hurts the economy, and slows it down, and either recession or soft landing. Soft landings are rarer, but why? And I've had a little bit of a look at this, and as always, there's theory. So a couple of theories. Corporate sector and household sector, and this is very much about the US. The US mortgage market is very different from ours. Are you familiar with the US mortgage market?
I am, because I think we talked about this before, because aren't fixed rate mortgages in the US for much longer periods of time, sort of 30 years?
Exactly right. So they're 30 years. So they don't have the culture of 2 and 5 year fixed like we do in the UK, 30 year fixed. And before the financial crisis, which led to The Big Short, we've covered The Big Short, the film.
We have.
They did have a spate of subprime and basically variable rate mortgages that ended in tears, as we all know. But basically, the standard mortgage is 30-year fixed. What does that mean? It means that 80% of mortgages outstanding today are less than 5%. So you've got some very old mortgages from when rates were higher before, but it's only the really new mortgages today which stand at about 7.5% that starts to hurt. And therefore, the consumer is in pretty good shape, and at one stage you could get 3 to 3.5% mortgages, and the consumer's feeling pretty good. So that's the consumer side. In contrast, as 2 and 5 year fixed roll off here in the UK, maybe more trouble ahead. We'll come to that. But the other extraordinary aspect is obviously interest rates have gone up, more expensive for corporations.
Yes.
So you would expect interest payments to obviously increase and maybe start eating into profits.
Yes.
They're not.
But it's not happening.
They're not.
Well, especially because when we first talked about that Magnificent Seven a couple of months ago, I think, and normally you would expect higher interest rates to impact growth stocks, wouldn't you? Because they tend to be because of forward earnings, they tend to be, they're discounted because of higher interest rates, and they tend to suffer a little bit, don't they, when interest rates go up. That hasn't been the case with the Magnificent Seven. And from what you're saying is perhaps that hasn't been the case generally with corporate America. They seem to be able to sort of manage these higher interest rates.
Yeah, so there's two aspects going on here. So one, I think you correctly identified, is that the Magnificent Seven, which is basically the FANG stocks, think Facebook, and now Meta, of course, Apple, etc., and adding NVIDIA into it. These are very long-term cash flows. Mm. Current cash flows are good, but long-term cash flows, and you're seeing that come through. And therefore, if as interest rates go up, you discount those cash flows that become less valuable. It's kind of finance 101. So that's one aspect, and you're quite correct there. What I'm actually talking about is hard cash. So okay. Net interest payments. So, you know, you and I work for Apple, and we have to, you know, we have net interest payments. Are we receiving cash? Are we receiving income because of cash? We have cash on the balance sheet. Or are we paying out because Apple does issue bonds? Net interest payments in aggregate as a percentage of profits are a 60-year low.
Really?
It couldn't be any healthier.
How is that possible?
Yeah, it's good, isn't it? It's a trick. So this is the trick. Firstly, there's a culture in the US. We mentioned about the culture in terms of mortgages. There's a culture in the US of companies issuing longer term debt and not relying, using the corporate bond market, not relying on borrowing at the bank, one. And companies successfully locked in very, very low bond yields and basically are paying 2, 3, 4, maybe even a one handle on some of its debt. In contrast, as a company like Apple, Berkshire Hathaway, et cetera, are successful and bring in cash, it's earning 5 today. This is net interest.
Okay.
So earning 5 and paying 2, 3. And by the way, paying the 2, 3 is tax deductible. So it basically means in aggregate, now there'll be some smaller companies that will struggle. Of course there will. And there'll be smaller companies that are highly leveraged, so-called junk companies, high-yield companies, that will be paying 8, 9, 10 for new financing. But in aggregate, it's very healthy. So going back to kind of answering the question, a theory, because there's lots of theories. One theory why the U.S. economy is really simply not in recession is that the consumer sector via mortgages is in very, very good shape. And the corporate sector in aggregate is in good shape. And therefore, you're not having the big layoffs, the big rises in unemployment. They don't need to. So, okay. And that looks to continue, I would say.
Yeah. Well, okay. But then how is it that inflation is coming down?
So fair. Money supply. Do you remember yes. Need to Know on monetarism? Again, these are theories. No one really knows. I mean, obviously, there's a commodity and energy price impact in the sense that on headline inflation, as the oil price goes down, as gasoline prices go down, makes an impact. But on a core basis, yeah, inflation absolutely is falling down. Why? It's falling rather, not falling down, it's falling. In my view, the contraction of money supply. So okay. The Fed has done enough to stop this excessive money supply growth, as has in the UK. And it's had the best correlation. Not enough for a quantitative analyst to say money supply does this, therefore inflation is that. But if you think of it more broadly, the explosion in the money supply in 2021 led to inflation in the United yeah. States because it didn't have the energy issues that we have here or to much lesser extent. And now it's falling rapidly. So that's what I would say. But yeah, these are all theories. And as we know in finance, very little can be proved.
Okay. I have one final question for you, and it's about the consumer sector. So we said it's in good shape. Now, obviously, a lot of that, I'm guessing, is still because of built up savings during the pandemic. Those surely now are being eroded. Is there not a concern that a lot of this consumer resilience is built on credit card spending?
Good question, Sarah. I mean, it always has been. There's been concerns about consumer credit in the States because credit cards are so freely available. Mm. for as long as I've been an investor. And it's come as almost the business model to have a lot of defaults because, you know, obviously rates are 20 to 30% and you have a high default in it. I think you are onto something there. That's the decline in the money supply. It shows, it does show exactly what you're saying, that some of this money's been spent. And so look, are we predicting no recession? I wouldn't go that far, but are we predicting something mild? I think this is what the comfort on the household sector on mortgages and the comfort on the corporate sector would make me think, yes, even as that bites, Sarah, it's going to be mild.
Mm. I did notice actually this morning, I heard, I think Goldman Sachs have reduced the probability of a US recession now to 15% or something. They're very bullish.
They are. And coming our way. But, you know, we said it first many, exactly. many months ago.
Everybody's jumping on our bandwagon.
Before we were on Apple Podcasts and the like, when we were doing this as more of almost a private thing, you had to search hard on the Coutts website to find this podcast.
Yeah, we're out there now. All right, then. So just to sort of sum up then, we had the US jobs report out on Friday, and what it's showing is that it looks like the Fed may well be able to achieve that magical soft landing. Why? Because basically corporate America and consumer America is in good shape, and there are a number of reasons that we've talked about as to why that is, but it's looking positive at the moment. We're certainly not saying there isn't going to be a US recession, but certainly a soft landing is looking perhaps more likely. Okay, let's come on to the next topic then. And it was about, which is obviously related to that, about interest rates, about where we are with markets at the moment. And it was prompted by the fact that National Savings have launched a one-year bond at 6.2%. That sounds very good.
So this has a bit of a UK focus, but it's a similar message for US dollar or euro investors, in the sense that you can get attractive one-year and two-year fixed rate either savings bonds in the various countries, or I'm going to come back to actual bonds in the market. So yeah, it's made a lot of headlines, 6.2% 1 year. A couple of points about it. You're locked in. Mm. You're absolutely locked in. Now, it is an attractive return, you're right. It is government guaranteed, but you are absolutely locked in. And look, for conservative investors, I can see a reason why they'd look at it, but much more tax efficient. Not that we give tax advice, you're going to have to do a tax warning as well as a compliance warning on this. But gilts have been CGT-free since 1986,
okay,
when I started my career.
So explain how that works.
So a gilt with, for example, a 0 1/8 coupon trades at 95 over 1 year.
As in 95% of its
price. They're issued at 100.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was originally issued at 100 in the crazy days when rates were zero. Remember that, Sarah? When rates were zero and the government were issuing debt with 0.125 or 0.25% coupons. Well, today they have to reprice to the 5% world. What does that mean? In very broad terms, it means a one-year gilt with a very low coupon will be priced about 95. And that gain from 95 to 100 is tax-free. Right. As daily liquidity is also government guaranteed. So look, this is interesting, but you're locked in for 1 year, and for the very wealthy, I think it's limited to £1 million. Gilts are far, far better in terms of after tax. For anyone who's paying tax, gilts are far, far better. A lot of private clients in the UK, this is nothing to do with Coutts, but it's all, you know, if you just Google private clients buying UK gilts, you'll see many articles about that. So that's what I'd say. But does it undermine the case for equities?
Well, that was going to be my next question.
Well, yeah.
Does it?
So I keep asking the questions you're going to ask me. So
putting me out of a job.
What do you think I'm going to say?
Well, I know what you're going to say, but I know what you're going to say. I think you're going to say it doesn't change the case for investing.
So it doesn't. I've learned it the hard way. For clients who want to be very tactical, I used to be very, very tactical. It's very hard. Now, look, the way I would focus this is have a differentiation between cash management and growth investing. And it's not just for equities. We're going to talk about an alternative in a moment, but mainly equities. So we have mentioned this before. We'll mention it again. We've done some research, Joe Aylott in our strategy team. So this is a bit from Coutts. what rate of interest, historically at least, has really undermined the case for equities? Yeah, absolutely. Higher interest rates, everything else being equal, is less good for equities. We can see that. Yeah. But the number is 8%. You recall that, Sarah. We've done that work, haven't we?
Yes, exactly. It's something we've talked about a lot. In fact, we did a special episode of Need to Know entirely devoted to the subject.
Yeah, so it's a click on that if you want the in the detail. But basically, 8%. Could it be lower this time? It could be. What about the evidence? And again, we've mentioned this.
Yeah.
Pre the financial crisis.
I was just going to say, when have we had a period in time when we've had, because it seems like forever since we had interest rates at the level they are now. So when was the last time we had interest rate, long-term interest rates, roughly at where they are now, and what happened to markets? So what's your evidence?
So I'll look at the UK to start with, but similar picture in the US. So in the UK, these are base rates, but the bond yield will be a little bit less, but these are base rates. So pre the financial crisis, 03 to 07, those 5 years, the UK rates averaged 4.5 with a high of 5.75. So you could earn 4.5% compound on cash. In the US, actually, it was a little lower. It was 3%. I've got the numbers here. But what did stocks do? Okay, this was spectacular. I don't expect this. In dollar terms, global stocks earned 120%.
Right.
Absolutely blowing cash out of the market. Interestingly, it was a strong period for sterling, that period. It's a very rare strong period, multiple-year strong period for sterling. But in the UK, the number was 77%.
Yeah. Obviously, we've got to caveat that because we're not saying that that's what's going to happen this time with higher interest rates if they stick around for a little while, which if we listen to Hugh Pill from the Bank of England, that's possibly what he thinks should be the case. But we're saying that this is what we can only, we've got, as you say, it's all about theories. All we can do is look at what's happened in the past in similar situations, can't we?
Yeah, absolutely right. All we're saying is what's happened in the past.
Mm.
And what happens in the past gives me some reassurance that equities can deliver. They're a growth asset at the end of the day, driven by earnings growth, can deliver at this level of interest rates, at least. It's evidence. And, you know, we've done the work going back, I think we went back to 1930 on this idea of what rate of interest really undermines the stock market, and that's 8%. So, look, I don't expect anything like that going forward, for what it's worth. But, you know, but I guess I'm saying over the next 5 years, will equities outperform cash? I would get so. I would put money on that over 5 years as a long horizon. Next year, who knows?
Yeah.
But that's not a forecast, and strong compliance warning will come at the end.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, of course, the other thing is you are locked in for a year, which might be work for you. And we're not saying you shouldn't take out national savings bonds, or you should invest. We're not saying either or, one is better than the other, but we are saying that, you know, you're locked in for a year, which does restrict a little bit what you can do. And also, I mean, as I mentioned Hugh Pill, because he's basically saying the path for interest rates in the UK, he said it should be more like Table Mountain than the Matterhorn. So he's advocating higher for longer, isn't he? Which is going to make it very attractive for savers, but that's not guaranteed, and we don't know when that's going to change. And I suppose the other argument is, when you do then decide you want to go back into investing, you don't know what the market's going to be like when you've come to the end of your fixed term on your bond, what conditions are going to be like, and if it's going to be so attractive as an entry point.
Yeah, fair point. What we didn't mention there is that the nature of equity returns, again, we have covered it, that the surges that you get. So, for example, in that period of 03 to 07, between June 06 and June 07, it was a plus 35% period.
Yeah.
So if you miss out on if you're earning 5-6, whether you're a dollar investor or a sterling investor, and you miss out on one of these, you know, stellar periods for equities that are so hard to predict, it becomes very, very tough. But look, that's where we stand. We stand by equities as the most attractive long-term savings vehicle. but it obviously has risks.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so just to sum up then, so it's, you know, it's a challenging environment for investors at the moment with interest rates looking so attractive. And we've just seen the national savings 1-year bond being sort of offered with guaranteed 6.2%. But, and we're not saying one is right and one is wrong, but we are just putting the case for historically, interest rates need to be a little bit higher before we would see them having a negative impact on equities. And you have to, if we look back to the last time when we had interest rates at a similar level, actually equities did remarkably well, despite the fact that interest rates in the UK averaged 4.5%. But as I say, it's there for information for you. Okay. And there will be a disclaimer at the end. Right. Last one then, just changing the mood slightly. We've talked about various different alternatives to equities, having put the case for equities. We've talked about Wimbledon debentures. We've talked about luxury handbags, watches, diamonds. You've got something a little bit different, another debenture.
Yeah, so a couple of clients have mentioned this to me. Basically, it's possible to buy seats as debentures at the Royal Albert Hall. And historically, they have definitely competed with equities. So you like the Royal Albert Hall, Sarah?
I do. I have been a few times. Yes, I have. I think it's a fantastic venue.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's special, isn't it? Your favourite concert, can you think?
That is easy. That was, I went to see Brian Ferry just before lockdown. It might have been one of the last things they did at Royal Albert Hall before lockdown. And it was tremendous. I'd never seen him live. I'm a sort of Roxy Music, sort of early Roxy Music era fan of Brian Ferry. And so it was wonderful to hear him doing things like Virginia Plain and the Strand. It was, yeah, really, really amazing night. And such a great atmosphere there and such an incredible space to go and watch live music. What about you, Alan? What's your favourite concert?
Well, for that, his voice obviously was still going strong at his age. It's amazing.
Yeah, it was a little bit, the first half was a little bit dodgy, but he got going in the second half and it was, yeah, tremendous.
Yeah, so for me, I'm a sucker for film music. And so, you know, The Magnificent Seven, love talking about that. But the late greats, because he sadly departed, Ennio Morricone.
Yes, yeah, spaghetti westerns.
So not just spaghetti westerns, but yeah, so spaghetti westerns, yeah, the good, the bad, the ugly, that's the one that everyone knows.
Mm.
But also beautiful music like Gabriel's Oboe from The Mission.
Yes. Yes, of course.
That's absolutely beautiful. If you Google that, listen to it. But actually, interesting fact, such a genius. The good, the bad, the ugly. Good, the bad, and the ugly. Everyone knows that film. Everyone knows that music. Mm. Do you know what his inspiration was?
No.
To basically hear that music. He was struggling to come up with the soundtrack for the spaghetti western. Sergio Leone, isn't it? And he obviously,
yes,
Clint Eastwood's
right.
in it, etc. And a very young Clint Eastwood. And he was walking outside the Rome Zoo. Okay. And he heard the animals talking to each other, as they do at night, hooting at each other.
Yeah.
The next time you listen to The Good, the Bad, the Ugly, you can basically hear, it's almost like that was his inspiration, the animals talking to each other. But he's a genius of also using voice. And yeah, Ennio Morricone, you know, the concept was absolutely fabulous. So yeah, and... tremendous energy. He was already, I don't know how old he was then. He was already very old, but tremendous energy then. But anyway, but as investments,
yes,
they've been good.
So really?
They are much longer than Wimbledon debentures. Wimbledon debentures are 5 years.
Mm.
Royal Albert Hall debentures go on for hundreds of years.
Okay.
Two seats, they currently trade at about 300,000.
Okay.
Whereas 20 years ago, they were about 50,000.
So how much? 300,000? Did you say?
I missed that, Sarah.
Sorry, did you say 300,000, Alan?
Yeah, 300,000.
Okay. And the 50,000, what, 10 years ago, yes?
50,000 10 years ago. And
okay,
it's a bit like Wimbledon debentures in the sense that when you don't want to go, you can sell off the tickets. You basically can hand them back and sell them back, and you earn a yield of about 4%.
Okay.
And there's some inflation proofing in there, in the sense that obviously ticket prices go up over time. So
However, you know, 4% is on the low side today. And, you know, I'm a bit reluctant to say going forward they'll compete with equities. Mm. I'm nearly always reluctant to find something that will compete with equities going forward. But nevertheless, they have. And where do you find them? Amongst other places, Harrah's Estates seems to be the market maker. And again, just like we talked about diamonds earlier, bid offer spread. These things have very, very wide bid offer spreads. So it's not like equities, where these days in major markets there's almost a zero bid offer spread.
Yeah.
The cost to transact is very, very expensive. But, you know, nice idea. And for the very, very wealthy and lovers of music, you know, not a bad idea to earn 4% on your tickets for the ones you don't want to go to. And I can see it, but I can't see the capital growth that we have seen, to be quite honest. Yes. But look, I know a lot more about Wimbledon debentures than I do about Royal Albert Hall debentures. But yeah, if anyone wants to Google them, you can just Google Harrah's Estates and Royal Albert Hall, and you can see the tickets for sale.
Okay. And just one final question then. So with Wimbledon debentures, if I've got a Wimbledon debenture for Centre Court, I can sell those seats to someone. It's sort of frowned upon a little bit with the Royal Albert Hall. Is that true?
Yeah. Well done. That has been in the press. Yeah, I'm glad you said that. In Wimbledon debentures, you're absolutely encouraged to sell at a premium price. That's just the way the market works. The All England Club themselves will buy back the tickets at a premium price and then presumably sell them on to mainly the hospitality industry, I would guess. In contrast, what you're meant to do, as I understand, is basically hand the tickets back to the Royal Albert Hall, who then sell the tickets at face value to you and me.
Okay.
And
pay you a dividend, essentially, for
dividend from the unsold tickets. But I did have a quick look on the likes of StubHub and Viagogo, and I did see some on there. Now, whether they came from, you know, people who own debentures, who knows? But, you know, it is a little bit more frowned upon. But the return of 4% is enough. Mm. You know, it competes with, notwithstanding what we just talked about, 6.2% available from the government. You know, 4% is quite an interesting yield. And, you know, nice, you know, if I had the money, if I win, you know, 20 million on the lottery, because the only way, or if this podcast makes us a lot of money, I would consider it.
Okay. So in summary then, so we've got an alternative. Well, I think we've come to the conclusion it's possibly not an investment, but it is something for music lovers. There's a Royal Albert Hall debentures and saying it's £300,000 you'd pay now, but it's sort of like
for two,
and that's roughly 100 years duration, so much longer period of time than Wimbledon debentures.
Hundreds of years. Yeah, historically. We can see historically they've actually they've competed with equities. Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. But it's probably like all of these things, you do it because you love it, not because you think you're going to make some money on it.
Right.
Because you've got that potential then yield on that investment and some inflation proofing as well. Well, thank you very much, Alan. A reminder that the views expressed in this podcast are not intended to constitute investment advice, are accurate at the time of recording, and are subject to change. Thank you very much, Alan, for joining me today. Don't forget to check out the podcast page on Coutts.com. And of course, if you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast via whatever podcast platform you happen to use. You can also access previous episodes there. In fact, we did mention the one we talked about. We did this very special dedicated episode where we looked at investing in a higher interest rate environment. We'll be back next week with more Need to Know. Until then, bye for now.